week of October 9th, 2016, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 339, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz. Episode 339.
Okay.
That's a lot of episodes.
That is a lot of episodes, yes.
Wow. And people, you know, probably realize that, you know, if the show lasts an hour, 10 minutes, hour, 15 minutes, we're probably recording for like 2 hours a lot of those days.
Yeah. You know, really what we have, you know, before and after the show, like the pre-show and the post-show, it's a lot of locker room talk.
That you mean those casual off-the-cuff stuff we don't really mean, obviously. Do you save all that audio?
I don't, no.
Ah, okay, never mind.
Are you just kind of making sure if you ever run for president, I don't have...
No, it's not important. It's not important. You erase it all, right?
I do erase it all, yes.
Great, great, okay. So what's on this week's show?
At least that's what I've told the Washington Post. I don't know.
What's on this week's show?
On this week's show, we're going to look at the PR fallout, speaking of PR fallout, from the soft opening of Birth of a Nation. It's never a good sign when a movie opens and people look to place blame. Also, a congressman asked the government to look into China's inroads into the United States entertainment industry. Is this just xenophobia, like the worries in the 80s that Japan was about to take over America? Like, you know, Gung Ho. Remember that movie?
I do.
Or is it something new, Michael? We'll find out. During our book filter segment, Michael, you're going to leap into a time tunnel and
nice.
Tell us what you think of a new nonfiction book. It's called Four Futures. On Inside Baseball, we'll discuss the ongoing battle over theatrical distribution. Netflix made a deal with iPick to release about 10 movies day and date with their debut on Netflix. So they're going to release in theaters, the iPick theaters, and on Netflix at the same time. And it's no surprise what NATO, the National Association of Theater Owners, or is it North? Yeah, it's the National Association. Yes, National Association. I don't know why I forgot about that all of a sudden. They're not happy about it in any case. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll debate the rest of the week's top entertainment headlines.
Debate.
Yes, yes. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link from ComScore in our show notes. We also look at, you name it, The Hollywood Reporter, Variety, LA Times, New York Times, Box Office Profit and Mojo, The Numbers. The number one movie around the world, thank you, Tim Burton, it's Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. $57 million over the weekend, $145 million worldwide. So a good, solid international start for that movie. And number two around the world is The Girl on the Train, based on the best-selling novel. Kind of mixed reviews, but it opened to $41 million worldwide. And since it cost $45 million, they'll probably be just fine.
You know, I don't want to go back to Miss Peregrine, but I was really surprised that we actually had a screen count and an international market count this weekend for this film.
What do you mean?
For Miss Peregrine's, I mean.
What do you mean you're surprised by a screen count?
Yeah, 12,187 screens in 75 international markets. That kind of, you know, normally you just kind of hear how much a movie made and that's it.
So is that a new trend or is that a new offer that ComScore is offering or what is that?
I don't think it's ComScore. I think it's the studio. Frankly, I think.
Oh, so they were just boasting about the number of screens it's on.
Probably, yeah.
Okay. At number three around the world is Operation Mekong. This is a Chinese Hong Kong crime drama based on a real incident. We talked about it last week. $26 million over the weekend. That's just about to pass $100 million, and that's just from seven territories.
And if you think about it, this weekend we had Girl on a Train opening in first place in the U.S., right? And it made $24 million.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Operation Mekong, $26 million.
Well, that's right, because the Chinese box office is soon to be the number one box office around the world.
Right.
At number four is Deepwater Horizon. My friend is going to go see that at the iPic Cinemas here in New York City. They just opened up the luxury theater chain. It's just down by South Street Seaport, and he's going to see that particular movie, Deepwater Horizon. It made $22 million over the weekend. It's at $66 million and counting. And number five is Storks, the animated movie about what the storks are going to do when there aren't so many babies to deliver. $18 million over the weekend. They passed the $100 million mark worldwide. And number six is The Magnificent Seven. That's starting to do quite well overseas. $16 million over the weekend, $135 million worldwide. Pretty soon it's going to pass the U.S. box office overseas. At number 7 is I Belong to You, a Chinese romantic comedy. $12 million over the weekend. Another movie that's about to pass $100 million worldwide. That's just from one territory, which is, of course, China. And it's hard for us to get budgets for some of these movies. You know, it's less mentioned and talked about in the Chinese press that we have access to. So Operation Mekong and I Belong to You, we don't know what they cost, but we're going to guess, I don't know, right? Below $20 million?
Depends on the film.
Could be $20 million. Yeah, and that's, they're not big, elaborate, epic pieces. So, you know, we don't know. So if anybody has any access to information about budgets or reported budgets, let us know. How would they do that, by the way?
They could actually email us. They could email dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. They could also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You know, you could also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or just search for Showbiz Sandbox and our account should come up. Same thing for Facebook. You can like us on Facebook, just search for Showbiz Sandbox. Our page should come up and we post stuff there all the time. Also, some of our listeners will post news stories they're interested in during the week, and we kind of look at those and see which stories people like.
In fact, one of our regular guests, Aaron Rich, had sent in that link about the congressman asking the Justice Department to look into Chinese investment in the American entertainment industry. I saw that from him before I even saw it online, and now we've got it in the show.
That's true. Yes.
And at number 8 around the world is Renee Zellweger's romantic comedy, Bridget Jones's Baby. Another $12 million over the weekend, $145 million worldwide.
I'd say that's a hit.
Absolutely. At number 9 is The Secret Life of Pets, another hit animated film. $9 million over the weekend, $850 million worldwide, which is a lot, but not as much as Finding Dory, which made another $9 million over the weekend. And as we said, has now passed the $1 billion mark. 3 movies have done that worldwide this year, and they're all from Disney.
Yeah, what I love is that one of the stories I read said, it's only the third movie to surpass $1 billion. Like, I'm sorry, was that not good enough for you? That's like, Michael Phelps wins only the 25th gold medal of his career. It's like, what?
At number 11 is Don't Breathe, the horror flick. $9 million over the weekend, $140 million worldwide. Tom Hanks is at number 12 with Sully. Another $8 million over the weekend, $167 million worldwide. Remember, this comes on the heels of that movie, Hologram and the King, which was one of the worst performing movies of Tom Hanks's career. That's a movie star, right?
I would say so, yeah. I mean, the mark of any star is the ability to rise, fall, and rise again. And so, I mean, I'm not saying that Tom Hanks has fallen here, but, you know, this is a big hit for him. And guess what? He's got that Inferno movie coming out, which I'm sure will be a big bomb. And then, you know, or, you know, I say that, I'm joking. But if it is a bomb, then, you know, he'll have to rise again.
All right. And number 13, here's one of the big box office stories of a week. The Birth of a Nation opened to $7 million on its opening weekend here in North America. It did not pass the $10 million mark as they had hoped. But if you look at all the past winners of Sundance, the audience award winners, this is probably one of the biggest opening weekends of all of them.
Yeah. And I know we're going to talk a little bit more about this later on. And
I was just trying to put it in perspective of, you know, Sundance Audience Award winners and how Sundance movies do at the box office. The expectations were very, very high, obviously. It was a record price to buy this movie, $17.5 million, and a big planned marketing campaign. But the truth is that Sundance Audience Award winners don't always score at the box office, and this is probably one of the best openings they've ever had.
Yeah, and I think it won both the Audience Award and the top prize, so the
That's
Jury
right.
Award.
Yeah, exactly. It was the double winner.
Yeah.
At number 14 is Middle School, The Worst Years of My Life, based on a book written by James Patterson, $7 million in its opening weekend. And then there's Masterminds, Lord, Legend of Ravaging Dynasties. Is there any news down here? I think there's a opening overseas is a Monster Calls, which has opened in one territory. I'm not sure which one, but this is based on the Patrick Ness novel. Perhaps it opened in the UK because he is a UK writer. That opened to a modest $4 million on its opening weekend and a few mixed reviews from the North American trade press. So we'll have to see where that ends up, but it is a great book. So yeah, we were talking about the box office around the world. Finding Dory crossed a great milestone when it made $1 billion. And Birth of a Nation fell short of its milestone. They were hoping to open to at least $10 million and a wave of Oscar buzz. Instead, it opened to some complaints about who dropped the ball.
Right. Well, and at this point, it's kind of, I mean, if you haven't heard about this movie and the controversy surrounding it, movie's about Nat Turner. It's a kind of a, I don't want to say a biopic, but it's a historical drama about a slave revolt in the 1830s. And it was directed by a rising star, first-time filmmaker Nate Parker, who has been an actor. And Nate Parker, his history kind of caught up with him, no pun intended, where he was accused of rape in 1999. He was tried, not convicted. He was acquitted. However, his co-writer was, well, indicted and convicted during the same crime or the same alleged crime, and then was never retried. He appealed and the conviction was thrown out. So there's a lot of controversy surrounding the people who made the film. And the question was, can you separate art from the artists? And I would argue in this case, the answer is no. That did not happen.
Well, I would argue in this case that it was a classic case of Sundance hype not just being met by the box office. That if none of that had happened, I think there were a lot of question marks about this movie. I think they just, you know, they acted just because it got, I mean, this movie got a standing ovation at Sundance before it opened, before anybody had seen it.
And I remember that.
That tells you about the desire for people to have a movie that they could applaud in the wave of Oscars so white, in the wave of Hollywood not representing black people well for historically. They wanted to say, yes, look at this. We have a movie we can champion and be proud of. And I think they just got ahead of the actual movie, because when you looked at what happened at Sundance and you looked at the reviews and you looked at the roundups of the best movies at Sundance, we pointed out a lot of people did not list this movie as one of the best films of Sundance. And that's not a high bar, by the way. That's no slam on Sundance, but you go to a film festival, you're lucky to walk away with three or four really great movies. This was not on that short list. A lot of critics said, oh, it's important, but they had caveats. And we've been saying since the beginning, look, don't think that this is some sort of, you know, Oscar controversy. If this movie doesn't get tons of Oscars and win Best Picture, they got way ahead of themselves here. And in fact, you can see a link in our show notes to a piece by Owen Gleiberman, the film critic at Variety.
Yes.
And his think piece about the movie begins with, I wasn't a big fan of the movie.
Yeah.
You're like, well, there you go. That's pretty much says it all, right? A lot of the critics had issues with the movie. And if they're not excited by the film, that makes it a really hard sell to audiences in general, because this is this type of movie that needs critical hosannas.
Yeah, and I guess so. Maybe the best line of his Owen Gleiberman's piece here is, from the moment of that original standing ovation, and he's talking about the standing ovation at Sundance, the movie has been
before the movie aired.
Yes,
before they saw the movie.
Yes.
You know, let's keep that in perspective.
And I remember reading that at the time. I was at Sundance, and I thought, well, why are they giving
weird
a standing ovation before the movie plays? Maybe it's played already, and those people are saying, no, it was the first screening. And I thought, well, that's kind of, you know, it's obvious that this Oscar so white moment, which, by the way, had happened that week. Okay.
Yeah.
So it happened that, like, the Oscar nominations were announced and Sundance started within 7 days. And so there was a lot. And actually, while I was on the plane flying to Sundance that year, I turned to the person next to me who was also going. I was looking through the catalog and I pointed to The Birth of a Nation and I said, and that's your Oscar winner. I mean, your Sundance winner right there. That's going to win. This movie would have to be horrible for it not to win Sundance. And sure enough, it won both the audience award and the jury prize just because of what was being placed on it, which is what Owen Gleiberman was trying to say in his piece. And what Kim Masters wrote about in The Hollywood Reporter was more about how once this Nate Parker's past caught up with him and his
they had an issue they had to deal with,
right, and that they hired PR experts and they Oprah Winfrey, who had originally praised the film, kind of, you know, tried to tell him, look, go on Gail King's show on CBS and, you know, you can do your apologies there. But Nate Parker, despite all of, you know, Fox Searchlight's input, despite the crisis PR people's input, he did not apologize.
Well, let's just say this is a post-opening piece where people are trying to lay blame. And so the people at the studio or whatever are saying it's his fault. And I'm sure he would say it's their fault or it's the media's fault. Everybody's pointing the finger at somebody else. So I don't want to just say, oh, it's all Nate Parker's fault. I don't think he did a good job on his media tour. Even in the friendly space of the Steve Harvey show, he wasn't able to strike the right note. And I agree with that. But, you know, it just didn't work. I don't think it would have, if the controversy had never happened, this might have been the opening weekend. So I just as they played too much burden on the film at Sundance before they'd even seen it, I think they're placing too much burden on the controversy about this movie just to blame its opening weekend. Fact is, it just may not have clicked. It's a hard sell. It didn't have very great critical reviews. So why are you surprised?
You know, I think Kim Masters really hit the nail on the head here. She writes, his inability to act like he cared that people invested a whole lot of money in him. Sorry.
That's a classic Hollywood attitude, though, isn't it?
Right. He says, you go in. So this is she's quoting somebody here, an executive who says, you go into the life is too short category. And then that same person noted that the first half of the New York Times review of Birth of a Nation is taken up with the controversy. And the person added, no matter what Nate Parker makes, this will always be the first paragraph.
Well, I disagree with that. And I think, again, that's a very studio executive perspective.
Correct.
Hey, dude, you know how much money we spent on your movie? You know. And I understand that attitude, but that's, again, it's not a very good movie. It didn't get very good reviews. It was overhyped from the very beginning. Many Sundance films, broad comedies, serious dramas, get overhyped there, and then they open up and they flop, or they don't do well. This is not a horrible opening. It's just not a good opening. They're probably not going to make their money back, but it'll probably be okay in the end. He'll go on to make other movies.
Well, and in fact, back in 1999, when Nate Parker was first accused of rape, you know, there was a little film coming out of Sundance called Happy Texas. And this was a big, big deal. Why? Because somebody paid, I think it was Miramax.
$10 million?
$10 million for this film. It was all the rage of Sundance that year. And it was released to, I think, $500,000. And I think total, it made $3.92 million. And it's always held up, Happy Texas, as the film where Sundance hype can get the best of you.
And speaking of hype, that's what we want to know about this issue of China. A Republican congressman, John Culberson, sent an official letter to the Justice Department saying, hey, China sure is investing in a lot of entertainment companies in America. Is this something we should be concerned about? Are they going to have an undue influence over our media? And he wants them to look into Wanda's purchases in the United States.
Yeah, okay. So John Culberson is the chairman of the subcommittee that oversees the, what is it? It's some appropriations committee, basically. And it's a trade committee. And he's saying, look, they bought AMC, they bought Legendary, they're bidding on Carmike. This is a soft power play. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, so far, it seems like all of the purchases, the acquisitions, they're legal.
Well, he's not saying they're not legal. He's just saying these are not purchases by individual companies. These are purchases by companies controlled by the Communist Party of China. And in the New York Times, he says, quote, these acquisitions, as well as many more co-financing arrangements, allow Chinese state-controlled companies a significant degree of control over the financing and content of American media that raises serious concerns about how this may be used for propaganda purposes.
Well, and, you know, some might fault this for being xenophobic, at least from the U.S. side. But in a way, Wang Jianlin, the head of Wanda, who is at least China's richest man and the head of Wanda, which is the world's largest real estate developer, he's just as xenophobic. He would like to keep foreign companies out of China, and it's specifically Disneyland or Disney itself.
Oh, that's right. He's got like a couple theme parks that are competing with Disneyland in China. And I think he was complaining recently that, hey, Chinese people should go to the Chinese amusement parks, not to Disneyland. And why are we letting these foreigners in? Didn't he say something like that?
Yeah, he said he would like to change the world where rules are set by foreigners. And he was referring to, changing the way things work in China.
To which American or international companies might say, hey, you already have a lot of rules keeping us out of your country.
Yeah, I mean,
did
I think
you
it's kind of
notice that
it's kind of funny. It's like, okay, do as you say, not as you do. I mean, it's like, okay, so yeah, you. In other words, foreigners shouldn't come into China and start setting rules, but you should buy up everything in another country and set the rules there. Which, by the way, many people would say is actually happening, because when we'll talk about Netflix and what their plans are in China and why they don't have very many plans in China and why that is, because, you know, if there's anything to this and to this whole thing of a Justice Department investigation, it would be not the fact that Wanda is buying up all of these properties, and there's now, you know, they're in talks to buy Dick Clark Productions for $1 billion. Many say that's overpaying by maybe a factor of two for that particular property. But the fact that they're paying $1 billion here, $1 billion there, let's buy, you know, Odeon in the UK and Europe for, you know, $1.1 billion, or I think it's $960 million, you kind of wonder where they're getting their money from, because they're wealthy, but they're not that wealthy. So the ties back to the government, that could be an issue. The other issue, of course, is the fact that there is no free trade in China, so a company like Wanda can earn a fortune without, you know, kind of unchecked in that market. I mean, I guess ultimately what I'm saying is, you know, and many journalists have been saying this for years, is that the World Trade Organization, China became a part of the World Trade Organization. Because of that, they were supposed to lift quotas on importation of media. They obviously haven't done that. So if there's anything to this, you know, look, make the playing fields even on both sides of the Pacific. That's what I would say.
Right. And whether anything will come of it, we can't know, because it's hard to peer into the future, isn't it?
I guess it is hard to peer into the future, unless you're writing a book, of course, then you can actually write whatever you want, which is our way of moving into our Book Filter segment. Book Filter is a book lover's best friend, which is a plug, Michael, for your website, Book Filter. And it's the one place you can go where you can, you know, every week you choose from thousands of books coming out. And this week, your number one pick is what?
This week, the number one pick I'm recommending to listeners of Showbiz Sandbox is Four Futures by Peter Frege. It's a nonfiction work, and it's about two converging threats. It's sort of a thought experiment. He says, look, we've got two big waves coming here. One is automation is replacing a ton of jobs, and we've got global warming. And so he sees a future where there may be a lot of fewer jobs and a lot, possibly fewer resources. And so he's imagining four different futures. Now, this isn't like Megatrends where he's trying to predict the future. He does posit four possible futures, one in which there's growing inequality and yet a lot of resources, or growing inequality and very little resources, or shared prosperity with very little resources, or shared prosperity with a lot of wealth. But his point is not which future will come true or what's going to happen, but his point is that our future is not written in stone or in microchips, if you prefer, and that it's a matter of political will and choice how we tackle climate change and how we tackle the threat and promise of automation. So it's an interesting, fun thought experiment. I really enjoyed it a lot. You've got to like a book that begins with, of course, capitalism is dead. That's like the beginning of the book. So it is fun. It's challenging if you're not of a liberal mindset. And I did find it really interesting. And that's Four Futures by Peter Frege.
So now let me ask you something. How many copies of this book need to sell for the publisher to go, wow, that was a hit?
Not as many as you would think. I mean, I doubt they paid any sort of advance to him to speak of. It wasn't a book that was hyped or, you know, bid over. So I'm sure if they sold 20,000 copies in hardcover, they'd be very happy. But that's just a really broad guess. You know, I don't really know. Actually, it may even be a paperback only release now that I think about it. You know, I deal with books in e-galley form a lot of the times. I will get final copies eventually. But in fact, this book is, and I'm checking it up right now, actually, it just came out in paperback. So yeah, it's from Verso, an imprint, and it's like $70 list price. So yeah, if they sold 20,000 copies in paperback, they'd probably be very happy.
Well, now, what if you sold 130,000 print copies of your autobiography and your name happened to be Bruce Springsteen? Is that,
that
good?
That is a very good opening week for Springsteen. Everybody I know is reading this book. All my media friends, all my music friends. I know like five people who are reading this book right now. I haven't started it yet, though I'm excited by reading it. I'm a big fan. But yes, it sold 130,000 copies in print. We don't know what it sold in ebook format, but it did debut at number one on the charts, the New York Times and the Publishers Weekly charts. So a very strong opening weekend for Springsteen's Born to Run. He has a companion piece album, which is mostly pre-existing tracks and a few rare early tracks. So I guess it's no surprise that it only debuted at number five on the Billboard charts. It's not like it's a new Springsteen album, but it's sort of a bummer for me that it didn't debut at number one on the book charts and the album charts. That would have been a lot of fun.
Yeah, you know, I had a couple of friends who went here in Los Angeles, and he's been doing this, I think, in nine cities throughout the U.S. where he goes, and he's doing it at Barnes & Noble's, if I'm not mistaken, where he goes and he, like, does a signing, right? But First of all, in Los Angeles, there was conflicting reports as to how this event would work, and Barnes & Noble's phones were, you know, inundated here in Los Angeles with people trying to figure out how they could get in line, when they had to get in line. And my friends went at 11 p.m. the day before, and the line closed, so they were only letting like 1,200 people in, okay? The line closed before midnight the day before, so they had to wait all day, all night, and then he showed up at around like 10:30, 11 o'clock to do the signing. All the books were pre-signed, so he wasn't really signing, but you got an opportunity to meet him, shake his hand, and have your picture taken with him. Well, think about it. 1,200 people? That was literally like you got 10 seconds. Every person got 10 seconds.
Well, I mean, book signings, you know, obviously a lot of people, normally they don't have to deal with that many. So right. You usually get a little bit more back and forth. I don't know what happened there. But I know in most cities they had tickets available in advance, you know, for free.
Yeah.
And basically they said most of the locations were sold out, you know, as soon as they made them available to fans. So you didn't have to wait overnight in line in most cities. But, you know, they're not used to dealing with that type of crowd. You know, it's that sort of unusual for them. So it's sort of something new for them to have to deal with, I think.
Yeah. And I told my friends, look, even if they gave you 30 seconds to take your photo and everything like that, you know what? 30 seconds for 1,200 people, that would be a 5-hour commitment. I mean, his concerts don't run that long.
And they run long.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, obviously that's just to get press and media attention. He can't go city to city and do, you know, 10,000 book signings, but, you know, it's a way to bring attention to the book and connect with the fans.
I think you should do public readings.
Well, I think he has, but
I know, I'm kidding. You know, like, oh. You know, he does concerts. He should, you know, read his book in public.
Okay.
Sell out Madison Square Garden.
Well, he's done that before, so that would be a big whoop, I guess.
Oh, okay. Yes. Okay. So you took the bait. I was trying to move us along into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story. I don't even know where to begin with this. The Today Show has made what amounts to a rapid fire turnaround in the morning news race and is now often beating Good Morning America in the key 25 to 54 year old demographic that's most valuable during that day part, that part of the day. So what they don't need to do is, you know, alienate, say, women. Cue the entrance of Donald Trump and video where he banters creepily with TV personality Billy Bush about babes. And I don't mean babies. I mean babes. Bush just became co-host of the 9 a.m. hour of Today, but the video has become a burning issue on the campaign trail, to say the least. Over the weekend, NBC went from saying Billy Bush would apologize on Monday to Bush would not even be appearing on the show Monday to saying Bush was suspended, quote, pending further review. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal for the Today Show. You know, you just name a new host for a certain hour and now you've got problems with them. There are some fascinating legal issues about how NBC had the audio, had the video, wanted to run with it, and was worried about the legal implications. And it turned out it was easier for the Washington Post to get sent video by somebody on the down low. They could run with it because they hadn't originally created the material. So they had no journalistic, you know, strangleholds on their use of it. NBC was a little worried because it was shot in California, which is a two-party consent state, meaning both people being audiotaped or videotaped have to know it and consent to it. And in this case, there was a question of whether that applied. There's also the video from The Apprentice. There's tons of unpleasant, you know, awkward video from, you know, outtakes of The Apprentice. We had a Hollywood Reporter story about crew members talking about the vulgar comments of Donald Trump and the obnoxious things he would say and do. They're sitting on a treasure trove of that stuff. And the question is, can they release it? Should they release it? Are they obliged to release it? It's an ugly, big mess. But all I know is I watched that video that they've been showing all weekend long, and my big reaction was not about Trump, because I thought, well, what's the surprise about that? My thing was, oh, God, Billy Bush. Oh, man.
Yeah. You,
I mean, it was so creepy when they get off the bus and he's like, hey, I've been giving a hug to the Donald. You're like, oh, my God, you're like enabling him. You're pimping him out. It was just awful. And you knew there was going to be a problem for him. I assume he can properly apologize for what happened and move beyond it. But who knows what will happen? I mean, Some people are already claiming he wasn't that popular to begin with on the Today Show. He already had a run-in with Al Roker. Maybe his new stint as the 9 a.m. host will fall apart.
Well, and then you can go and hang out with Kelly Ripa, which we'll get to in a moment. But that said, this could have been a whole segment. We debated, or at least I did, in my own mind. Well, gee, do you talk about the legal implications? Because basically, NBC had this tape for a week, and they were going through.
And they were preparing stories.
They were preparing stories. The way they were preparing the stories, by letting Access Hollywood, basically an entertainment news show, was going to break this news.
Well, they found the video first.
And
it was video from Access Hollywood. So it was an Access Hollywood producer. They said, hey, we found it. It's our story. And NBC said, fine, you can do it first, and then we will follow.
And
I think that's totally not suspicious. That's totally fair.
Yes. But however, part of the delay was that they were trying to cut around the Billy Bush stuff because, of course, that would damage their own.
They said no. They said they weren't. That wasn't what they were doing.
They did. Okay, so they denied that. But
absolutely. Yeah, they said from the beginning we knew that, you know, it was going to have to run, that it was newsworthy, and that the Billy Bush thing, you know, that was just part of the story. Well, there was no way to cut around them. They weren't trying to do that. That's what they say.
Do you think Billy Bush can remain on the Today Show after
sure.
this?
I don't see why not. You know, he can if they want him to, if they think it's worth it. If he'd been on longer, they'd have more invested in him because he's brand new. Maybe it'd be easier for them to dump him.
Well, when I hear pending further review, that means we're on the phone with our lawyers going over your contract to see how we can get out of it.
I'm sure they have a clause about a morals clause, and they could just say, I don't think that would be an issue.
But literally, to be fired for something that you did 11 years ago is, and not on that particular, you know, with a completely different employer, is...
What? You murdered 27 people 11 years ago?
Well, okay, that's a different...
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, it doesn't matter when it happened or how. If it damages you and makes you unpalatable to their audience, then they say, hey, we don't want to do business with you.
Now, of course, this whole brouhaha over the
I don't know about brouhaha. That's a little soft for something that could be construed as sexual assault.
Okay.
Trump posting about sexual assault. Let's not say brouhaha.
Okay, I don't know. I was trying to move on to the next story, and I was going to ask you whether you saw Saturday Night Live with Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Life is too short.
Life is too short. Hey, kind of like the executive that doesn't want to work with Nate Parker. Okay, well, the reason I mentioned that is because there was a joke in the opening monologue about Lauren Michaels asking for Hamilton tickets. And Lin-Manuel Miranda says, yeah, I'll see what I can do, but, you know, no promises. And he trots off, and Lauren Michaels says, I can do a matinee. And it was a very funny moment. But the Broadway musical Hamilton, as you know, Michael, has been tearing it up, trading the number one slot at the box office with The Lion King, which has made more tickets available for each show. So The Lion King says, oh, we can beat you. Heck, we're putting people in the rafters now. Now, how does Hamilton do it? How do they keep topping The Lion King? They do that by nobly fighting the black market. In other words, they keep raising their ticket price. The latest record numbers are for upcoming holiday performances around Christmas and New Year's. Hamilton is asking for $998 per ticket. Toss in the service fees, and that makes it the first Broadway show in history to cost four figures. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. You know, it's surprising they waited till the original cast was gone to do this. I think it was a question of optics and media backlash. They're not getting any. They've had the highest ticket price on Broadway for a little while now. Now they've set a new high. But again, the fact is, if you want to fight black market, just say, hey, who buys the ticket has to show up at the box office with their ID and walk in with the ticket. Problem solved. So don't pretend you're fighting the black market by setting record high prices. You're not. All you're doing is charging more money.
And actually, you know what? I did have to do that when I bought the tickets. I did have to show up with my ID. They did check my ID.
Right. Well, that's great. And did you have to walk right in with it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, they checked it not at the box office will call, but at the where they tear the ticket.
Right.
So, yeah, they basically gave me the ticket because I had the credit card, but then they checked the ID that went with the ticket. So they were doing that. And now, mind you, this was over a year ago. And it was
right, but I'm saying if you do that, then there's no issue about people reselling tickets.
Yeah, now, as you know, Michael, I did not buy tickets from the box office. I wish I could have. It would have been a little cheaper, but I had to buy tickets through a secondary market. And when I did buy the tickets through the secondary market, it was a big, you know, rigmarole to get my name on those tickets.
Yeah, well, that's the thing they want to move away from.
Right. Now, I could have sworn we covered this story already, but when you hear stories about the publishing business, and how many books are being sold and whether people prefer to read in print or ebook. Keep this in mind, Michael, and you know this. There's a lot we don't know. We don't know how many books are sold on Amazon. We don't know how many of those are ebooks. We don't know how many of those books that we don't know about being sold. We don't know how many of those are self-published. And Amazon, by the way, is the number one bookstore in the country, if not the world. All we can do is guess. And here's the best guess we have for 2015. Look at how many ISBNs, the International Serial Book Number, look at how many of those were paid for. Major distributor Balker, major distributor of those numbers, estimates that some 600,000 self-published titles were published in 2015. That's far more than all the major and minor publishers combined. Big deal or big whoop?
I don't think Balker sells the ISBNs, but they just sort of handle a lot of books that have ISBNs on them. What happened was we had a number of ISBNs that were purchased in 2015, which was over 700,000. And then some people said, how many of those are for the same book? Because if a book is printed in hardcover and paperback and ebook and audio and digital audio, those are going to be five different ISBNs. So they wanted to know, well, how many of those are unique books? And Balker crunched the numbers as best they could, and they figured most of them were just ebook only releases.
Right.
And so they're the duplicates of this particular set of numbers. These are book, you know, ISBNs bought sort of individually as opposed to by major publishers who buy them in bulk. So that's why this is not including those publishing numbers. So they figured all put it together, about 600,000 unique books were published by these self-published people. And that's how they got this number. It took a lot of crunching of numbers to say, well, should it be cut in half or a third, or how many of these are just ebook? How many got ebook and print? You know, it wasn't easy to do. It's still just a broad guess, but it gives us an idea of how many self-published titles came out in 2015, and it's a lot.
And I would wager that it's underestimating the number of self-published titles, and here's why. Balker, of course, is the administrator for ISBNs here in the United States, and every country has its own administrator. However, there are companies that go out and they purchase blocks of ISBN numbers for books and then sell them to people who are self-publishing. So what Balker is looking at is those that came directly to them to buy an ISBN number, and it might just be one number. Whereas there are companies that help authors publish, and they say, well, look, we have 500, 700, 800 ISBNs we've purchased. We'll give you this one.
And, you know, that doesn't count, of course, books published around the world. We're just talking really about North America. And not only that, if you self-publish your book on Amazon, which virtually every self-publishing author does, you don't need an ISBN.
That's right.
A lot of people just put it on Amazon. They don't need an ISBN. So we could be way under reporting how many self-published books are done. And of course, most of them will sell, you know, a copy to your mom. That's not a dig. That's just a fact that most self-published books are not going to sell more than a handful of copies if they're lucky. But it's a big market. And so when you talk about how many books were purchased last year, how is the industry doing? There's a lot of information we don't have. And this is a big source of that.
The BBC's Radio 1 is one of the most influential and important music outlets in the world. Their reach is
Why don't they play my music? That's what I want to know.
Do you have an album out, or is there...
I guess that would be a good first start.
Yeah, well, their reach is vast, and their staffing indicates a channel that may be in crisis. And what we mean is key player Chloe Pearson resigned from the network last week. Pearson is deeply involved in the creation of Playlists and the hugely important annual poll naming the hot new artists of the year. And that list is called Sound Of. And
like Sound Of 2015 or Sound Of 2016.
That's
right. It's a great franchise that they have.
And now Pearson is at least the ninth Radio 1 music executive to leave the station since Zane Lowe left for Apple Radio in 2015. The biggest poacher is, of course, streamers like Apple and Spotify. They've got the money, and Radio 1 is losing the audience, dipping below 10 million listeners, just as other UK radio is growing. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a very big deal, not just her leaving or even the executives leaving, but everything, the drop in audience, the loss of creative talent. And you've got this analysis of Radio 1, which is supposed to be the touter of UK music. And this analysis is, hey, we're looking at them over the past year and all the music that they're playing. 8 of the 15 top artists on Radio 1, the dominant people that they are promoting, aren't even UK artists. And so there's a lot of issues going along with Radio 1 right now. So I think they are definitely in a tough, tough transition period.
Now, we don't have a big deal or big whoop for this, but what did you think? France is now counting streaming towards certified sales awards.
Right. This is what happened in America with the RIAA. They said, we've got to accommodate streaming somehow. We've got to recognize it's happening. And so they are melding streaming into actual physical sales of product. And by physical, I also mean digital. So they're saying, let's count streaming towards sales. So an album can go platinum based on all of the streaming going on. I think it's wrong. I think every country in the world is going to do this, but I think it should just be recognized separately. You've streamed 100 million times, you get a streaming award. If you actually sell copies of albums, whether it's CD or digital audio or all these tracks, then that should be a separate award, because they are just two different beasts. They are apples and oranges. And just because you've streamed 200 million times doesn't mean anything. It could be all one track on your album. So it's a really apples and oranges comparison. I don't like it, but the entire world is moving that way because so much music is only being streamed. So that's where the attention is.
Well,
it should just be a separate award.
I agree. The French music trade body SNEP has decided that one sale, they're going to count the sale of music as 150 streams. So they're going in reverse.
Jeez.
In the U.S., it's, you know, a certain number of streams equal, you know, a sale equivalent, right? So then, if you 1,500 streams, and we'll count that as an album or whatever. But I agree with you. It's a different psychological choice to stream something versus to actually put money down. I'll stream something that I would never buy in a million years.
There are people who are streaming like two songs from an album and the other 12 are not being played at all.
Right.
So again, it's really messing up. You're not getting good information. You're not really touting what people are doing. Instead of pretending it's one big thing, just say, hey, you know, if it's the number one song on the radio with airplay, this is what you get, number one. If it's a number one streaming and it's been streamed 500 million times, do that and break it down by track. And now, you know, they're not playing the whole album. So, you know, don't pretend the album has suddenly gone platinum. They may have never heard the other 12 songs on that album. That's what's so crazy. An album can go platinum and nobody's heard most of the songs on it. That doesn't make any sense.
Well, and then you have Spotify and Apple Music. They are adding unofficial mixes. And this is what I loved SoundCloud for, is that you could go on SoundCloud and all of these artists would be uploading mixes of, you know, other artists' music. So you had Taylor Swift mixed with, Lana Del Rey.
Do you mean like a playlist, or do you mean like one song melding two different songs together?
The latter. So like these mashups where you, okay. You know, and by the way, also multi-track mixes. So that you'd have mashups and then playlists of mashups. So Spotify and Apple Music are now going to be streaming this, where that was SoundCloud's big advantage. That was, you know, they had these unofficial, you know.
How can they allow people to do that and then promote it officially and make money off it?
Well, because they did it. They have a deal now with Dubset, which is kind of identifying the songs in those mashups and then paying the artists.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how they're doing it. It's kind of interesting.
And obviously pretty soon there's going to be some mashup artist, DJ producer, who's going to shoot to fame based on the amateur mixes that they do.
Yes, I believe that person is Skrillex. Actually, it's already happened. TV news anchors, we've been talking about them recently. A hot property in this election year, unless your name is Billy Bush. So what better time to cut...
He's not a news anchor. Oh, I guess he is on the Today Show. You're right. From Access, I beg your pardon.
Well, the Bush family, we all said the Bush family was going to make an impact during this election. And sure enough, they are. So here's the thing. What better time to cut a new contract than during the election cycle when ratings are peaking? That's the decision of Anderson Cooper. He has re-upped his contract with CNN and taken himself out of the running to be a permanent co-host with Kelly Ripa on her daytime show Live. Kelly, we may have somebody for you. Just give us a week and there may be somebody available. Cooper already moonlights for 60 Minutes and travels the globe for his CNN job to follow breaking news wherever it happens. He felt it wouldn't be possible to be a good and consistent partner with Ripa. That's probably true. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's a big deal for CNN. It's a big deal for poor Kelly Ripa. We've now got Neil Patrick Harris, who also took himself out of the running. It feels like people are pushing themselves to the forefront to say, I can't do it.
Right.
They're just saying, you know, they were names that were bandied about the last time. And she actually, I think, really wanted Anderson Cooper. But I think he was her first choice. But I don't think they could make it happen, or he wasn't ready to cut ties with CNN, or her producers preferred Michael Strahan. I forget what happened. But, you know, ultimately the choice was hers, of course. But it's just, you know, it's going to be hard. It's a hard fit. She's going to have to find somebody else. And she's done a great job. And she feels like she got screwed out of her co-host. And now she's got to do it all over again. But I think it's most important for CNN because he is, I think, the face of the network.
Now, do you think that Billy Bush, should things not work out with Today, could he wind up at Live?
Oh, absolutely not, because they're even more dominated by women. You know, that's the that's the last audience that would want him.
The sequel to Mary Poppins is getting starrier every day. Emily Blunt, of course, is playing Mary Poppins in a sequel set around 1935 when Jane and Michael Banks are all grown up. Lin-Manuel Miranda is playing a street lamplighter a la Dick Van Dyke. Meryl Streep is playing a cousin of Mary Poppins. Ben Whishaw is playing Michael Banks, and now Emily Mortimer has signed up to play Jane Banks. Rob Marshall is directing, Scott Whitman will be writing new songs, Mark Shaiman will be writing the new score, and David McGee will write the screenplay. It's set to open on December 25th, 2018. I love the fact that they have a release date and probably no script. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, that's my entire point here. What a ridiculous big whoop. They've got everything except a movie.
Yeah.
Why are all these people signing on? Why is everybody lying? They don't even have a screenplay yet. Why would you even want to make the movie until you had the screenplay? It's not a good idea just to have an idea. I get this all the time in books. People say, I've got a great idea for a picture book. I'm like, there's no such thing. Everything is clever and great when you say, what about a sequel to Mary Poppins? Great. You know, that's not actually an idea. You have to actually do it. You have to actually create the book with the pictures and the illustrations and the words. You have to create the movie with the songs and the music and the screen. You have to actually write it before it's an actual good idea. And any vague thought that pops into your head is not a great movie. It's just a possibility. And I can't believe all these people are signed up for something that nothing is done on. I thought the screenplay was done. I had no idea that absolutely nothing was done. Until you have a screenplay and like three new songs, you say, hey, give me some ideas, the songs you want to do. Why would you be going forward? Why would you have a release date? I don't get it at all.
Well, I mean, maybe they wanted something to compete with Mulan. The live action, you know, they're redoing Mulan live action. They are redoing The Lion King live action. But at least Mulan, they kind of have a starting point, right? I mean, and they're just going to turn the animated film into a live action, you know, release.
Right, and they're going to do a worldwide search for the young actress that they want to star in the movie, who obviously will be Chinese. And but here again, at least this makes sense. You've got the Chinese market, you've got a movie that was pretty successful, and you've got a market in a country where you know it's going to be highly anticipated, which is soon to be the biggest market in the world. It's also well-known in the U.S., so at least this one makes sense.
Well, and I loved what one commenter said. He said, I was thinking, why are they doing a global wide casting search? There are many perfectly white actresses looking for a role right here in the U.S. I thought that was very funny. Now, okay, so since we're talking about China, let's stay there. Everyone wants to get access to China. We've talked about it on this show already. That may be the quick explanation of a new deal. Director Steven Spielberg's company Amblin Partners has sold a minority stake to Alibaba Pictures Group, the division of China's Amazon-like e-commerce giant. It's a strategic partnership to co-produce and finance films, as well as helping market and distribute them in China. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, right? It's just another company that wants access to China, and they're making a deal with a local partner to help that happen.
Right, and they're doing it in a way that gives them money to actually make the films.
So you wouldn't think Spielberg would have any trouble getting the money to make a film.
Oh, you know.
And yet.
Yeah, it's a tough business, this whole, making movies thing.
It was good of Hillary to plug Lincoln. I appreciated that during the debates.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty good. I was, well, you know, since Donald Trump got to plug his hotel in Washington, D.C. at the old post office. I think, you know, she had to plug something, right?
That's right.
She plugged her website quite a bit. Okay, so that brings us to probably my favorite story of this week. And you know what, Michael, let me ring up your order, okay? And so you're buying a new Adele CD, right? A Grateful Dead live bootleg. And what's this? Oh, a nickel bag of pot. That'll be $55, please, which can't possibly be true because everybody knows a nickel bag is $60. I mean, not that I would know that necessarily, but you know what I mean. Okay, that hasn't happened yet, but it may soon at the record store Amoeba. They've applied for a license to sell marijuana alongside their rock, jazz, country albums, EDM, you name it, they sell everything. So you can pick up a little Willie Nelson and a little Willie Weed at the same time. The record chain has seen its revenue fall in half since 2008, so they could use a new profit stream. They already have a medical marijuana doctor on staff. Get that.
That's somebody you walk in and they say, yes, you do need medical marijuana. They somebody on staff at Amoeba to do that? That's crazy.
I mean, and if you've ever been to Amoeba and inside Amoeba, you would definitely say, you're a medical marijuana doctor? Yeah, no, you're just a staff member who likes marijuana, okay? Because it's like, they are the most tattooed, pierced people I've ever seen in my life. But, you know, look, recreational marijuana is on the ballot here in California, so that whole medical marijuana doctor job may soon be eliminated. Who knows? Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop, obviously. Does Amoeba have multiple stores or is it just one big location in Berkeley?
They have one in Berkeley and one in Hollywood. And I can tell you that Los Angeles Magazine years ago did this whole like Final Four runoff of like what the best thing about Southern California was.
Well, I know Amoeba's, it's right up there.
And it came down to, I think, the weather and Amoeba. And Amoeba won. And so literally the weather in Amoeba beat out things like Disneyland and the and movie industry and just everything, you name it. And, you know, it was on there. Anything that's good about Los Angeles was listed there and it beat out everything. And then it really is unbelievable. This record, these two record stores are just, they're enormous and they have just about everything you can think of.
Well, when you're the last record store in America, that's what happens. There's about two record stores left in Manhattan that you can walk into, including Academy Records and Tapes on 18th Street. I'll give a plug to my friends. I don't really know them. They're not my friends. But, you know, it's one of the last few places you can walk in and actually see physical albums and CDs. But unlike Amoeba, they certainly don't have everything in the world. They're just not that big.
Well, and it just goes to show you how much streaming has impacted music sales, because for revenue to fall by 50% since 2008. That's pretty remarkable at a store like Amoeba.
Well, that's because the sales that are happening digitally, right?
That's true, yes.
Even when people are buying albums, you know, it's like, yes, the return of the LP and all that, but look at Amoeba.
Well, now let me ask you this. Will you buy, along with your bag of Willy Weed there, will you buy the new Rolling Stones album? It's the first studio album for them in over a decade. It's going to be called Blue and Lonesome.
Well, it's funny because actually I have a friend who has a showdown on his blog where he says, let's vote on these two albums and which one is better. And a few months ago, he did the Rolling Stones' Sticky Fingers versus Let It Bleed. And when he listened to those two albums side by side and vote on them track by track, I ended up saying, dear God, why have the Stones never recorded a blues album? You know, covers of classic blues songs. They should have done this, you know, 40 years ago. And in fact, that's exactly what they're doing now. They're covering some classic blues tracks. You know, they're a great band and, you know, their new material certainly hasn't been great in decades, but this could be just the thing to give them a little spark and bring out the best in them. So I'm actually kind of really excited about it.
That's exactly what these rock stars at the age of 77 need. A little spark to get them going straight through their 80s.
I thought that was a reference to pot again.
No, not at all. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. I guess this week, the way this story could affect you is you might be able to see the latest and greatest movies on Netflix or your local movie theater. Maybe.
Well, not the latest and greatest movies, but original Netflix movies.
That's
right. This is a deal signed between Netflix and the luxury theater chain. Is that what we should call them?
Yes.
IPIC?
Yes, they are. They basically are VIP based. So they, you know, there's like 50 to 100 seats. Not even. There's like 70 seats tops that I've seen in some of these theaters. They're nice and plush and you can lean back, fall asleep in them. They give you free popcorn. Unlimited.
It's a chain where you pay a fee to join, right?
You do pay a fee, I believe, yes. You don't have to, but it's, I think you can become a member, yes.
Oh, okay. And then the tickets are like premium priced? What are they?
I think they're $29 here
Wow.
Yeah, it's really quite expensive.
Wow. Good Lord. You won't see me there anytime soon. And there are 15 of them, I think, 15 of their locations around the country.
Yeah, and they have, you know, a great restaurant in the lobby. And it's frankly, it's a restaurant with a movie theater attached or a movie theater with a restaurant attached, because the restaurant itself could stand alone. Sherry Yard is the kind of executive chef for all of them. So, and a, you know, a James Beard award winning chef.
So it's an upscale art house sort of cinema. Do they have mainstream movies playing there, or are they more sophisticated, like IFC, or what are they?
Both. I mean, I've seen main. When the last time I was there was to actually review the Westwood location for Celluloid Junkie, and it was all mainstream movies.
And oh, so you didn't pay $30? Have you paid $30 to see a movie at iPick yet?
No, I have not.
Will you do it anytime soon?
Probably not.
Yeah,
but, okay. But I will say the list of amenities is lengthy.
I'm sure it is. When they've just opened up a location in New York City, as I mentioned, and my friend is seeing a mainstream Hollywood movie, Deepwater Horizon. He's seeing that, I think, tomorrow. But they have 15 locations, and now Netflix has signed a deal with them. Obviously, major studios and streaming sites and other people are trying to figure out what works best day and date as far as showing movies online and in theaters. And Netflix signed a deal with iPick that 10 upcoming movies, including one that already came out, would play at iPick day and date with when they played on Netflix.
And what I'm trying to figure out is, okay, so what does that actually get you? Like, okay, iPick
well,
has
it gets them an Oscar qualifying run, doesn't it?
No, not that that's what I mean issue. Is, why is this? Is this basically Netflix saying, "Hey, we have booked a movie theater." Okay, yeah. Well,
but it's day and date, which is what something that people haven't been able to do so easily for big Hollywood movies.
Correct.
Right. So this is they've already had a movie starring Jamie Dornan that opened up on Friday called The Siege of Jadeville, if I'm saying that right. Upcoming next, I think next Friday, is Mascots, the latest mockumentary from Christopher Guest. That will play on Netflix and at iPick. So you can see it at home if you own Netflix for $8 a month, or if you like, you can pay $30 to see it in a theater. And at the same time, the Netflix CEO, Reed Hastings, piled on along with James Murdoch to say the theater owners are strangling theatrical distribution. They need to be more forgiving and more open to experimentation. What did NATO have to say about that?
No way. We don't like it. They basically said, look, this has been tried and it's failed. John Fithian from NATO said, we all should tread lightly and be mindful that over the years, the film industry's success is a direct result of a highly successful collaboration between filmmakers, distributors, and exhibitors. To which I would say this. One, what is in this for I still don't get what's in this for iPick. Why would iPick?
Access to some movies that aren't available anywhere else.
Except
unless you have Netflix.
Unless you have Netflix. But okay, fine. I don't get that for iPick. As far as what Reed Hastings is saying is, you know what? I've written this on Celluloid Junkie as well. This is, unless Reed Hastings is willing to let all the movies that are being shown on Netflix also be shown on another service like Amazon Prime or, I don't know, Apple, the same type of subscription VOD service for a cheaper amount, then he really shouldn't be speaking. I mean, because basically what we're talking about here is he's saying, I don't like that distribution channel, which has exclusivity. Well, he also has exclusivity in his distribution channel. So he's kind of speaking out of both sides, in my opinion.
Well, I disagree with everybody.
Why is that?
Well, because I think this is just a model that has been going on for years now. This battle is over. Movies are released on video on demand and online before they play theaters. It's what we see for independent films and documentaries all the time now. This is over with. This has happened. You see it at IFC. You see it at the Sundance movie theater chains. You see it at independent theater chains. This is already happening. There are movies that only open in a few major cities, and then they're available video on demand in the rest of the country right away. Or they're available on video on demand even before they open the movie theaters. It's not happening with big Hollywood movies, but we're not talking about big Hollywood movies, are we? We're talking about a Christopher Guest mockumentary and this sort of stuff. If a studio wants to try it, hey, they've been trying it for years now for indie films. If they want to try it with their big $100 million movie, knock yourself out. Probably not a good idea, but hey, it's already happening. Why are they so upset?
Well, I think because Reed Hastings is kind of saying, hey, the next Marvel movie should be released day and date.
He doesn't have the next Marvel movie. Who cares what he says about a Marvel movie? If he makes a movie for $200 million and wants to do it day and date, then we can talk. Well, but again, this model is already in place. It happens all the time. So to act like this is some crazy new idea, it obviously works for independent films and documentaries. It does for small budget movies. It makes sense. You're never going to open some certain indie films or documentaries on 2,000 screens. So why not, when you're getting the reviews and you're getting the press attention and you're getting a little visibility by opening it into major markets, why not make it available to people in most of the country where they don't even have the ability to go to a theater and pay to see it? Why not make it available video on demand? Makes sense to me.
Well, and it is my understanding what Reed Hastings was talking about was not only movies that Netflix made, but the movies that he is purchasing and licensing from studios. So,
and like he, what? He like, gets them long after they, he's right. saying, I want them right away.
Right, correct.
Right, well, of course, yes. Knock yourself out. Of course, he said, why don't you give me your movies right away? Well, sure, why wouldn't he say that? Who right. cares?
Yeah, well, and I think probably the most important part, he was talking at some conference. Probably the most important thing he said in this whole thing was that Netflix has no plans for China. That they looked at what happened to Apple, they looked at what happened to Amazon with their movie stores and said, forget it, we're not going in.
Because they feel like they would just be shut down at some point randomly? They don't have enough control or dependability?
Well, yeah, they have no control. And if Apple can't get a movie store up and running, how are they going to? So they just said, you know what? The government has a stranglehold on media in that country. There's no point in spending a whole lot of money, a whole lot of effort in China because there's nothing in it for us. We can't win there.
Well, why is every other major media company in there then?
They're trying.
Right, they're trying.
Right, so, and not succeeding. And they're look and Netflix, and I think smartly, is looking at what's going on there and saying, well, gee, Apple, Amazon, they just got beat down. Why would we want to do the same exact thing?
Because it's the biggest market in the world?
Yeah, the world can be pretty big. Go fish somewhere else.
Well, you could go fish in Poland.
I've been to Poland. It's a lovely country. I don't know why.
Have you? I've never been there.
I don't know why are we talking. Oh, I know why we're talking about Poland. Because Andrzej Wajda. He died over the weekend at the age of 90.
Yes, he did. And he helped me get one of my first apartments.
Okay, what? Wait, are you serious?
Absolutely. I was trying to get an apartment on my own in Long Island City, Queens. I'd looked at a place before a year earlier. I didn't get it. I went back a year later. There was an apartment available again. It turned out to be the same apartment on the ground floor in Long Island City. And the owner, showing me around, was Polish.
Okay.
And he says, you know, and he asked me, what do you do? What do you do? You know, this, that. I go, well, I'm an entertainment writer. I write about movies and music. And he said, oh, yeah, yeah. Have you heard of Krzysztof Kozlowski? I go, of course. I've interviewed him. He's a tremendous. He's like, you've interviewed him. I go, oh, yes, absolutely. I've sat down with him and interviewed him. He's a great director. I love this movie. I love that movie. He's like, oh, have you heard of Andrzej Wajda? I go, of course, of course. And I start to mention his World War II trilogy, A Generation, Canal, Ashes and Diamonds, Man of Iron. And I said, oh, Danton, the French film I love with Gerard Depardieu. It's a master. He said he didn't even know that movie. You know, he'd seen the Polish ones, but not the one in French. I said, oh, you should. He's, oh, my God. He starts talking to me again and again. He's so excited. I know these Polish directors. He's so thrilled. You're going to get the apartment. So, thanks to Andrzej Wajda, I got the apartment. So thank you. Thank you, Andre.
I don't think Andre really knew he helped you. I've got to be honest.
He did not know me.
Yeah.
But he lived a good long life. He delivered some great films right up towards the end. I mean, Katyn in 2007 is a solid movie. His newest movie is just finished. It's called After Image. And Poland just selected it to be their submission for the foreign Oscar competition. So, you know, a major, major figure in cinema, some great, great movies. If you haven't seen that World War II trilogy or the Man of movies or Danton, it's a lot of really terrific movies ahead of you.
Well, certainly if you see any of those movies and like them or hate them, hey, you know what? Let us know about it. You can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Now, of course, we urge you to subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. And that information, ways to subscribe to us, rate and review us, ways to contact us, as I just mentioned, ways to follow us on Twitter, @ShowbizSandbox is our handle, or like us on Facebook, just search for Showbiz Sandbox, or links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. They can all be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's howaboutahugforthebushy.com.
I'm not touching that with a 10-foot pole. But you know what? If you're looking for some of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry, I don't know, head on over to the Huffington Post, or you can see where all of Michael's work is aggregated on michaelgiltz.com, or you can head on over to bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.